from New Orleans. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Musicians are generous storytellers, so it's impossible to squeeze every story each of our guests tell into a single show. That's why this week we're sharing outtakes. We've got Mashiya Lake, we've got Erica Falls, we've got Ricky Lee Jones, Terrence Blanchard, Tom Sankton, and Maestro Carlos Miguel Prieto, as you've never heard them before. And who wouldn't want to hear a story like this?
He had a straight razor up his sleeve. He pulled that razor out and just hit him right across the midsection.
Ouch! Outtakes on Music Inside Out. After the break. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and we are sharing more of our guests than we ever have before now. Some of the outtakes from our recent shows are too good to miss. So let's get started. Most of our guests, no matter what instrument they play, think about, talk about, and obsess about tone.
Bum, 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 bum.
That's singer Mashiya Lake. She says she sings scales before every performance.
Let silent cry, never tell him nothing, don't tell him nothing, never tell him nothing, let him fret, then sweat, never tell him nothing. That's what gets results. If you find you're having trouble keeping guides within your reach, you can fix this on the double. Practice what I preach. Let him fret, let him sweat, don't tell him nothing, never tell him nothing, never tell him nothing, let him sigh, let him cry, never tell him nothing. That's what gets results.
But Lake says she'd rather sound more like Maria Callas, one of the world's finest sopranos, whose voice seemed perfect in its imperfections. The passion in Callas's tone dazzled the opera world, but ultimately ruined her voice and her career.
Well, what ruined her was a man, but Aristotle Onassis is what really ruined her. But, yeah, she was criticized for being heavy on her low end, but that's what I found so beautiful about her voice is the richness and the passion.
And the harshness sometimes.
She didn't sound like everybody else, and that's why she stands out. That's why she was criticized, but that's why she was special. Because oftentimes I'll hear an opera singer and be like, who's that? I don't know, because they all got trained to sound the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. I mean, what Callas seemed to not mind is to allow her voice to sound harsh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You
it
know
has
what I mean?
A hard
in,
edge
in
to
performance.
It
exactly. So while others are trying to be pretty, you know what I mean? She's trying to really convey
she
what this
brutal.
Character
right.
was going through at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
That's and why she was the best.
Is that from Carmen?
Yes.
And
track number 16 on the double CD. But
thank
I
you
encourage
very much.
People to look it up on YouTube so they can see her performance.
Yes.
And the satisfaction on her face that she's getting just from the instruments playing, and then while she's preparing to just let it out like a train horn. I mean, it's really incredible.
Let's listen.
Ooh.
That was Maria Callas in the title role of Bizet's Carmen. Callas is one of Mischa Lake's favorite singers. We're hearing outtakes this week from Music Inside Out, stories that musicians told us that are too good to miss. Falls sings a kind of music that's also taxing on the voice. She's a soul, gospel, funk, and R&B singer. And like Mischa Lake, Falls is a sucker for tone.
Sunday morning rain is falling. Steal some covers, share some skin. Clouds are shrouding us in moments unforgettable. You twist to fit the mold that I'm in.
It's not all about the vocal ability as far as runs you can do. I love tones. That's why I love people like Stevie Nicks and Carole King, and because the tones were so beautiful and different. Nina Simone, it's something that when you heard it, you knew who it was. So that's what I love. That's what let me know about a great singer, their tone.
It's true, because when you think about it, I mean, look, you look at somebody like Billie Holiday, her range is not that great.
Right.
You know, I mean, I shouldn't say that, because who am I to say that?
No, but it's not that wide. Great. Right.
Yeah.
I get it.
And all. And yet, you know, she can communicate so
yes,
well.
It's about telling a story.
Yeah, which is really the difference between somebody shouting at you and somebody explaining something to you.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. And that's what you want to do as a singer. You want to convey the story. Whether you've lived it or not, you still want to tell it, because somebody in that audience will be relating to it. So you want to make sure that, you know, have clarity in what you're saying.
About like young people, you know, who are very much encouraged to have these big arena voices, you mm-hmm. know, but who over time, as they mature, you know, won't have those big arena filling voices anymore. And so it seems like a positive idea to learn how to do other things with your voice.
Learn that and learn your lane. You have to know your lane.
Yeah.
Some people don't know, and they try to sing things that's not for them, and you can ruin your instrument that way. If you want to sustain, if you want to be a Gladys Knight or Patti LaBelle or, you know, all these phenomenal singers who are still legendary, Tina Turner, and still can take down a house, that's what you have to do. You have to know your instrument and
that's
know
it.
Your lane.
It's true. I mean, long before Whitney Houston passed away, I wondered about her, because her voice in many ways at her prime was like fire coming out of a dragon. It was
Lord.
That strong,
yes.
you know. And I always wondered to myself, like, how is she going to sustain that
yeah.
over the years? And then periodically she would start doing songs that required more storytelling, as you're saying,
mm-hmm.
and not the fire so much.
Right.
And it seemed like she was going to mature well.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
just a shame that she didn't get a chance to.
I know. One of my idols, man. I love Whitney Houston. Definitely one of my idols.
Yeah. You know, I saw on YouTube recently a performance that she gave many years ago to, mm-hmm. know, U.S. service people.
Yes.
And she sings that song, All the Man I Need.
Yes.
And she is in such command of the audience
mm-hmm.
with just with her voice. She's not dancing.
Right.
You know, just with her voice, that literally when she shakes one man's hand, he swoons.
Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about, because I have watched that a million times.
It is so beautiful with the red dress.
Yes.
And in the morning when I kiss his eyes, he takes me down. And then
Houston with All the Man I Need, performing live in 1991 for U.S. troops returning from the Persian Gulf. Singer Erica Falls says she's seen the YouTube video a million times. We're hearing outtakes, stories from Music Inside Out guests that are too good to miss. Most of the musicians we interview say tone communicates straight to the heart of the listener. But Ricky Lee Jones says tone unlocks languages that humans find difficult to understand. That's beautiful.
That's a dove.
Is that a mourning dove?
Yeah, that's a mourning dove. And in the West, they have a three tone at the end. They go boo, 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 boo. But here I hear they just go, boo, boo. And I, not knowing exactly what I'm saying, I don't talk to them too much because I'm not sure if I'm saying, get off my tree. I don't want them to go away, you know. But once in a while, I talk to the mourning doves.
That's lovely. Yeah. That's lovely.
I have a philosophy that I'm not really sure why science hasn't just deduced this, but if we hear it, and if we see it, it has a function. We can only perceive of what is relevant to us, what has something to do with us. So if we hear a bird, it has something to do with us.
Yes.
So I think a lot about these small details of our lives and where I fit in, and it really brings me peace. And I hope that I'm able to articulate before I leave this physical plane the things that I sense. And they're really simple, but, you know, the simplest thing is hard to make people have that grok moment, like
exactly.
Stranger in a Strange Land, right? Grokking, where you really understand what the other person is saying to you. So I haven't quite figured out how to convey it, but I will before I'm done.
Jones likens her voice to that of a horn or a reed instrument, and a tone that bewitched her early was on a 1958 album called The High and Mighty Hawk.
I didn't know anything about jazz, but I wanted to learn about jazz. So I was at the Salvation Army, and they had these piles of records, and I picked a couple records. I took home a bluegrass record, and I took home a jazz record. I still have those records.
Wow.
And Coleman Hawkins, for me, still is the greatest saxophone player, because that's how I came into it. Mm-hmm. And he also stays with the melody. He doesn't go too far out. And I like that. I'm a singer. And he also has a texture and a tone that's so sexy and loving.
Yes.
This little vibrato and real thick thing he does. And I don't know a lot of jazz history, but I do sense that he is the beginning of what came after him, even though after him I heard that the new guys of the 50s kind of poo-pooed him. But he was the beginning of improvisation in that standard, pop standard kind of thing.
Thank you.
flush of your cheek will never I speak tells me that you are my own. You fill my eager heart with such desire. Sets my soul on fire. I give myself to sweet surrender. My world alone.
And yet, romance is but one color in Jones's palette. The same woman who can sing My One and Only Love also advocates for civil liberties in her music. Jones is the only guest we've interviewed who wrote about the 2001 Patriot Act, which expanded the ability of U.S. spy agencies to monitor American citizens.
Can you believe that? And they're still doing it. They're still doing it.
This is like gospel and politics, which, you know, they've been married before. So it's very interesting to see them married on your record.
You know, I think that Marvin Gaye did this, in my experience anyway, first and best. And while it wasn't gospel, when he wrote about the ecology, mercy, mercy me, the ecology, I don't think anybody was writing about the ecology.
That's
so
true.
Not only is he coming out of soul music, but he's carrying the banner of cultural and social issues.
That's right.
And as a 19-year-old white girl, I was just like, wow. You know, he opened a big door to me to kinds of music and that you could write a great song and have it be about something that mattered like that. Not to compare myself with Marvin Gaye.
Jones's song is called Tell Somebody, Repeal the Patriot Act.
Up at night, it was not brother against brother, mother against a mother.
Tell somebody,
and you've got to tell somebody,
tell somebody
what happened in the USA. Now they wanna to just get.
Is Ricky Lee Jones with Tell Somebody. This is Music Inside Out, and we're hearing outtakes from some of our recent interviews. Musicians are telling stories never heard before now. Coming up, maybe the most violent story we've heard to date. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We talk for a long time with our guests, sometimes hours, and that means we have plenty of outtakes. Leftover gems that have never been heard until now. Tom Sankton is a journalist and author who also plays traditional jazz. He learned the clarinet from George Lewis, the man whose tone set the standard for many New Orleans musicians. Sankton wrote about his training in the 2006 book Songs for My Fathers, a New Orleans story in black and white. As a white teenager in the 1960s, he was a mainstay at Preservation Hall, where black and Creole players became mentors. But this was the Jim Crow South, and while Sankton's parents and some of his fellow students at Ben Franklin High School chafed against racial segregation, others did not.
It wasn't an entirely segregated school, but it was almost. And so the milieu I grew up in is a white, uptown middle-class kid, was totally separated from the milieu that I embraced as an aspiring
musician,
New Orleans jazz musician. And I was very much aware of that difference. In fact, the several times I tried to enlist some schoolmates who played music in this effort to kind of learn from the musicians at Preservation Hall and elsewhere, I got like a cold shoulder. I mean, they just were not interested and thought I was kind of weird.
And describe their disinterest in some of the ugliest racial terms. I mean, you know, in this idea that it's not that they weren't interested in music.
Yeah.
They just didn't want to hang out with those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the N-word was bandied about, that's not the kind of crowd that they wanted to hang around with, that their mothers wanted them to be taking music lessons from. That kind of thing. So
So the musicians, though, that you hung out with, I mean, these, in large part because of their age, I mean, these guys had seen everything. I mean, they'd seen it all and had dealt with a lot. You know, you tell a hell of a story involving Chester Zardes, the bassist for Preservation Hall, who talked about a dangerous encounter, you know, he had on the street one night.
Yeah. He was telling me about how hard it was in those days, and I guess this would probably go back to maybe the 1920s or something. And he said those white boys used to run the hell out of us. You know, that they were harassed, insulted, attacked. And he told me about a story one night. He missed his streetcar, and he was walking down North Rampart, and two young white boys, I guess college boys or high school boys, kind of drove up in a car and started, you know, hey, N-word, and, you know, hey, what are you doing? You know, don't you hear me talking to you? And Chester said, I just tried to go on about my own business and keep walking down the street. And the guy got out of the car and slammed the door and said, you know, hey, boy, or worse than that, hey, don't you hear me talking to you? And in Chester's own words, the way he said it was, that I looked at him, and it said, why don't you go on about your own business while you can go? And the guy took a punch at him, and his Chester said he had a straight razor up his sleeve. He pulled that razor out and just hit him right across the midsection. The guy said, oh, Johnny. The guy just cut me. All of his entrails just kind of spilled out on the street. And the artist ran away. And the next day in the paper, there was an article about two white boys had been attacked by a colored man, and one of them had been killed by this colored assailant.
Every part of that story is chilling. Every part of it.
Absolutely.
And so it's just extraordinary that that living in that reality, the fellows could also live in another reality that was so extraordinarily devoted to this beautiful music, you know. They were staking their lives on it.
Yeah, but I think music was one of very few avenues that were open to black people in those days for advancement, for, I guess, being able to make a living. It was what? It was sports and music.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think of who were the black people who made it to the top?
Jack Johnson. Joe Louis.
Joe Louis. And then the musicians.
Right. Know.
Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole.
Ella Fitzgerald, exactly.
Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, they made it to the top. They became stars. They became wealthy. They were admired. But in those days, there were very, very few avenues for black people to advance and to really achieve those heights. But music also, I think, was a way of dealing with the pain and discrimination and poverty, sickness. It was a way of humanizing all that.
Chester's artists often recorded with Billy and Dee Dee Pierce of Preservation Hall. That's his bass on Lonesome Road. That's Billy and Dee Dee Pierce with Lonesome Road, featuring Chester's artists on bass. Hearing Terrence Blanchard and E! Collective with Cosmic Warrior from their Grammy-nominated album, Breathless. Cosmic Warrior is not a bad way to describe Blanchard. He's everywhere, and he's not afraid to get physical. As a youngster, Blanchard wanted to become a professional football player, but his father killed that dream, saying football was too dangerous. Now, when Blanchard isn't composing or performing or touring, he enjoys boxing. Let us pause to appreciate the irony.
Well, the object is not to get hit. So that's, and your ego always takes over. So your ego says, I'm not going to get hit. Then you get hit and you go, okay, well, I'm not going to get hit again. It's a weird kind of experience to have. And whenever my best friend used to be a heavyweight champion. His name is Michael Bent, And whenever we're sparring, man, I'm always eager to get in the ring with him until he hits me the first time. And then I go, why am I here?
I took boxing. Well, I boxed for one day. I went to a gym in Washington, D.C. I was like, I want to box.
Okay.
And everything. And I said, okay, I want to learn everything, but please don't hit me.
Well, I'll tell you this. With Michael Bent, we always laugh about this, because I remember the first time we sparred, he didn't put on any headgear. And I'm like, hey, dude, you're not going to wear any headgear? And he goes, well, theoretically, T, you shouldn't hit me.
And well, he does have a point.
Right, and I didn't.
Yeah.
And I didn't.
It's like if you used to be the heavyweight champion of the world little trumpet player.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's fine. It's up to draw here.
And look, I've been studying with him for a long time. If you ever seen the movie Ali, the guy that plays Sonny Liston in the beginning of the movie, that's who I'm talking about.
218! Sonny Liston, the champion of the world. 218 pounds.
Pounds of what?
Pounds are ugly. That man's so ugly, when he sweat, the sweat run backwards off his forehead just to stay away from his face. Come on, you big ugly bear. I'll turn you into a rug.
Keep talking. I'm gonna f*** you up. Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. His name is Michael Bent.
Well, you know, I have to say I love boxing. I mean, I can't, I love everything about boxing except for actually watching a boxing match because I'm always so afraid of the people who are in the ring. But I love all writing about boxing. I love all stories about boxing. Sure. You know, who's your favorite heavyweight?
Oh, well, I mean, it's always a challenge because I like him for different reasons. I mean, obviously I like Ali, but Ali is not the person to show your kid when you want to teach them how to fight because he had such quick hand speed.
Right.
He allowed himself to put his hands in all the wrong positions. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But one of my favorite fighters is a guy like James Toney, who was awesome. He always looked like he couldn't fight because he just kind of came in the ring, but he was technically sound.
Yeah.
Knew how to roll his shoulders, knew how to cover, knew how to create angles, knew how to make you go for a punch that wasn't there.
What fight would you recommend people to see?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, obviously the one, you know, the Joe Frazier and Ali fight is a great one.
The first one?
No.
The second one?
Yeah.
The fighters touch gloves. The referee, Tony Perez, backs off. Frazier swinging wildly, hard, wanting desperately to do damage here. And real damage, a knockout if possible, but he's got to connect. Ali again landing a couple of punches in there. And one thing about Muhammad Ali that I don't think has ever been duly publicized, this man can take a punch.
That's Howard Cosell calling the 1974 Ali Frazier fight at Madison Square Garden. For Terrence Blanchard, boxing and music came together in 2013 with the premiere of his first opera in jazz. The opera is called Champion, and it tells the true story of a 1962 title fight in which Emil Griffith knocked out Benny Perrette. Perrette later died from his injuries.
And that's the thing about the fight that was so interesting is that, you know, there was this whole notion of Emil being a gay male in the world of boxing and keeping his sexuality close to the vest. People in the boxing world knew about it, but it wasn't something that was widely reported or if reported at all. And Benny Perrette and Emil had fought twice before, each winning a bout. So, you know, they're both trying to gain an edge on each other in this third fight. And in the press conference, you know, Benny called Emil a maricon.
Which is a very bad word.
Right, for a gay male. And it incensed, you know, Emil. But, you know, when the fight came about, I don't know if that was any extra incentive for Emil, but because Emil was just a ferocious fighter, you know. Well, let me back up. In professional boxing, the refs always tell you, protect yourself at all times.
Okay.
And it is incumbent upon your opponent to take you out. It's a violent sport.
Yeah.
So there's a moment where Emil hits Benny like 17 times.
17 times in 5 seconds.
Yeah. It's incredible. The thing that was interesting about it is the ref was a very, very reputable ref.
Mm-hmm.
A very responsible guy, but he's behind
Emil. Emil. Okay. So and Emil has the guy in the corner, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I don't think he could really see that Benny wasn't throwing back.
Okay.
You know? So Emil hits him 17 times, and he falls into a coma. He knocks him out. Falls into the coma for 10 days and he dies. The thing that some people don't talk about is what led up to that fight was that Benny Perrette was the type of fighter where he would take a bunch of punches to get close to you to throw one.
Oh, and like Ali Foreman, like what, rope-a-dope, that rope-a-dope thing.
But it wasn't a rope-a-dope. He didn't cover. He would just take these punches.
Dang.
And he fought a guy named Gene Fulmer, who was a heavy hitter before he fought Emil Griffith.
Okay.
And the thing back then is that guys didn't take long stretches of time off to
heal
between fights. So when Emil hit Benny, people thought, or a lot of people still theorized, that he was damaged from the fight before.
I see.
And shouldn't have been in that fight to begin with.
That's a scene from Champion.
Terrence Blanchard's Opera and Jazz was commissioned by Opera St. Louis and Jazz St. Louis and made its most recent debut in San Francisco. Despite the tragic subject matter of the opera, Blanchard continues to box. And word has it, he ain't bad.
Okay. Man.
You know, Bob Dylan is a boxer. He boxes. Can you take him? Do you think you could take him?
I don't know. He looks kind of fit.
He's very fit, and I think he's tough.
You know, he goes for walks every day. You heard about what happened to him?
No.
Yeah, he was walking in the neighborhood. He's on tour, and people thought he was something that he wasn't, and then they called the police on him. Which is a shame, man. It's a shame.
How many roads can a Mr. Man walk down?
Exactly.
Right?
You know what I mean? No matter who you are, yeah. There you go.
Well, he seems wily. I don't know. It might be a fair fight.
Yeah, of course. You know, look. Some of the most dangerous guys I've ever sparred with were some of the oldest guys in the business. The guys in the MMA, all every trick known to man.
Was composer and jazz trumpeter Terrence Blanchard. We're hearing musicians tell stories on air for the very first time. Coming up, Maestro Carlos Miguel Prieto reaches out to children, beginning with his own. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. We're hearing outtakes from some of our recent interviews. Musicians are telling stories we've never aired before now. Maestro Carlos Miguel Prieto conducts the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, the Orquesta Nacional de Mexico, and the Youth Orchestra of the Americas. He's also a revered guest conductor around the world. Prieto thinks a lot about young people. When he was a young man, he memorized Beethoven's symphonies. All of them. But in New Orleans, Prieto says brass bands unlock the same door to a lifelong relationship to music.
You know, when I walk around this city or when I bike a lot, I've seen kids in the street with a trumpet or a trombone.
That's right.
No case.
Yeah.
Okay? And they would just be, you know, one hand would have a trombone and the other would probably have a football or a frisbee or something like that. So to me, that's so natural because that's kind of how I grew up with the idea that the instrument, yes, is something that is difficult, but it's an object that produces fun, okay? And that, I think, was the great thing that that happened in my family, which is the fact that this communication that music is fun. I have to be honest with you. I haven't been able with my kids to communicate this.
Isn't that something?
And I don't know what it is, but my kids don't yet, hopefully they will, they're still young, don't yet have a relationship with their instruments of fun. They still see it as something similar to homework.
Could it be an issue of does the child have the right instrument? You know, sometimes a kid may begin with a clarinet, but that kid may ultimately gravitate toward a stringed instrument, for instance.
Kids are on a world of their own, and I wish I would know. So I suspect, for example, but I only suspect, that my oldest daughter has quite a special ability for painting. Okay.
Mm.
Yet she's taken maybe 100 hours of violin lessons and maybe 5 of painting. Okay.
Wow.
Why? Because, well, in my situation, I don't know how to steer her, you know, into the painting world. And so a lot of the circumstances around her may be moving her towards something that she may not like. So I always think that with kids, the more that they can find their own And I go back to our schools, okay? Yes. When you find a teacher that is able to find the love or the ability in the kid or the love for reading or the love for poetry or the love for a certain sport, that teacher is giving that kid the biggest gift they can.
Yes, okay? It's true.
So for some reason, my six-year-old is incredibly drawn, loves Einstein. And
really?
not little Einstein, okay? Albert Einstein. And you know, why? I think maybe because I have a biography of Einstein on top of a table and his hair is so wild or was so wild and he looks kind of weird and quirky. So he asks a lot about Einstein. And, you know, I say, okay, well, probably in school they can teach him a lot of things about Einstein. But, you know, how does a five-year-old come up with an admiration for Einstein? And how, as a parent, can you react and take that into something that could be very interesting? Because Einstein's life was very interesting.
Very.
And who knows, maybe my kid is interested in science or in physics or in, you know, mathematics. But I am not qualified for that.
But you know quite a lot about a lot of things. I mean, you were a Princeton grad, right?
Yeah.
Trained engineer. You have your Harvard MBA. You know, you've done some stuff, you know. And before you devoted yourself full time to music, you ran a sugar company. Isn't that correct? In
yeah.
Mexico?
Yeah. My life is just, again, the weirdest thing. I ended up being a conductor, which is kind of the weirdest career path that you can choose, right?
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. If I would have known, I probably would have avoided so many physics exams, math exams. I mean, which I don't regret, you know.
No,
I don't regret anything. But the truth is that I was one of those kids who had no clue at actually quite a late age, no clue what I was going to do in life.
In your own experience, though, in industry, right? You must have run into other frustrated artists, right, in your work and all. But, you know, if you could give someone advice about being in that predicament, at what point is it wise, I should say, to chuck it all in, like to give up industry, to give up your job at the sugar company,
yeah.
You know, and to devote yourself to, you know, I mean, to this very interesting, beautiful pursuit, but scary also.
I have to tell you, I think it's a very tough question.
Yeah.
Because it's a question that, you know, if I would answer to you anytime, just go for it, I would be ignoring some things that are very important, like nourishing a family or making ends meet and all this. But if you are 15, if you're 16, if you're 17, if you're 20-something, and you really have an incredible love, just pursue it. It is wrong to think that one has to devote one's life to what other people perceive is success, okay? And this is what worries me so much about material things on the internet or on TV, that it gives a perception to kids that success is material.
That's right.
And actually, the people that they are admiring probably did not see it like that. In other words, it's not Nike that makes LeBron James. No, it's effort and talent and work that got him there. LeBron could be barefoot and he would still be sensational.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James with the rejection.
Okay, full disclosure, our conversation with the maestro happened before the 2016 NBA Finals. But that series was amazing, and we couldn't resist.
Wow. His third block of the game.
Orchestras around the world are looking for new ways to connect with everyday people. Carlos Miguel Prieto contends that classical music is everyday music, particularly in New Orleans, where music fills the streets.
I have to tell you that when you see a jazz funeral here in New Orleans, God, the first time I saw this for me was, it changed my view, not only of the city, but about the incredible strength of music in the streets. And you know, this street music, okay, is actually what so many composers are trying to imitate.
Yes.
Yet sometimes we want to communicate out there that classical music is about this cathedral of thought and profound philosophy. Sometimes it is. But sometimes it is just an imitation of those moments that are so fantastic.
That's exactly right. I mean, unfortunately, you know, so many people believe that, you know, you're supposed to dress up if you're going to listen to classical music. Like, even in your house, you know, I better comb my hair or put my shoes on because I'm going to listen to, you know, Berlioz, you know.
Yeah.
But the truth is, it's so much better if you just put it on doing whatever you were doing. Washing dishes.
Exactly.
Because that's part of your life. It's got to be, music has to be just part of your life.
And it talks about part of your life.
Yes.
Instead of while you're washing dishes, putting on the TV with those morning programs that are not that interesting.
No,
okay?
They don't have much to
just
say.
Just put on an opera, okay? Just put on whatever, an opera by Berlioz, okay? We face three major obstacles in classical music. One is the perception that in order to go to a concert, I have to know something.
Right.
Absolutely wrong. The best audience is always the audience that just comes with a blank slate and just ready to be moved. The second one is the financial, okay? Most classical music concerts are actually less expensive than movie theaters.
Is that right?
Well, you can't buy and eat popcorn and Coke in a concert. So the price of the concert, of the ticket, is all you have to pay.
That's okay? True. No nachos.
No nachos. And actually, the third one is what you should wear or look like.
Right.
Whenever anybody asks me, what do I have to wear? I always say, just wear something. But I would say that to go out to the street, you know?
Just cover your bits.
Just, you know, and you could, you probably would not wear a mini skirt. But if you go to a concert in some of the most esteemed halls in the world, you will see people who are dressed just the same way as they were dressed to go anywhere else, but who come to hear the music. Of course, you cannot take the social part out of it. But all the musicians, we all know when an audience comes to hear the music rather than to look at each other. I wish we could, especially in this country, achieve a more balanced audience as far as portraying inside a classical music concert the real society around us.
Yes, exactly.
And this is... Well, excuse me for saying this, I'm not American, but this is a big to-do for us. Because even in New Orleans, where we don't have in our classical music concerts the same social component as the city. And I think you understand what I mean. And somehow, I wish that all our concerts would be attended by the same people who go to a Mardi Gras parade.
Exactly.
Okay? Everyone is partying or enjoying together.
Carlos Miguel Prieto conducts the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. I know they're in the right place, man. That's Giuseppe Verdi meets Dr. John and the Wild Magnolias. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Thomas Pierce, Sean Collins, Melissa McLean, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a full playlist of the songs played in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.